As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm joined now by a whole host of people, including JJ Bull the Bullet.
Hello.
How are you?
Amazing.
You were the amazing.
Yes.
Sebastian Stafford Blore, in person, in the blood.
Right here. Hello, Joe.
Hello. And of course, Jonathan Dog McKenzie. Hi, John.
Hello.
Yes, indeed. We're all joined by Steve Hankels remotely. I believe Steve can say hi from his home in Cambridgeshire.
Hello.
Look at that lampshade. Anyway, we've got so much to talk about today on the TIFO Football Podcast. We're going to start by discussing the very exciting game between Liverpool and Manchester City, a little bit of Arsenal. We're going to be joined by a special guest to discuss AFC Bournemouth, which is exciting. And then it's on to the continent, El Clasico, Union Berlin, and other countries on the continent before returning back to the Premier League to tie up a few loose ends. And if we've got time, maybe head to France, back to the continent. It seems a weird way of going around the journey.
It's kind of inefficient.
Back and forth. It's a bit like what you do, Seb, on a kind of weirdly monthly basis.
Yeah.
Some Serie A. And maybe there's a couple of, I don't know, we might plug a few things at the end as well. Maybe we would do that. Speaking of plugs, you should buy the TIFO football book. Yeah?
Yeah,
that's
you
the,
really should.
Now that's the main plug. Yeah. Do you like how that superseded the subscribe to
I
the
mean,
Athletic
if
plug?
You like stuff or if you like journeying to the continent, you know, it would be a good companion as you journey to the continent, the TIFO book.
It would, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it really would, yeah.
Always good to have a companion on the continent. Our special guest has joined a little early, so let's ignore him. But if you don't want to ignore him, you should subscribe to The Athletic. That's theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, where you can read him every day. You don't know who he is. You'll find out later, and the plug will work as a kind of episode-long arc. Does that work structurally, JJ? You weren't listening, were you?
Just listening for about 2 minutes, sorry.
In which case, let's begin the podcast. Right, let's begin with... what are we beginning with? Oh, Liverpool 1, 0 Manchester City. JJ, this was a very exciting... I enjoyed this game.
Did you?
I did enjoy it. I thought for the most of the game, it was 0-0, wasn't it? For 76 minutes of the game.
You were right, it was for a lot of games. Many games are.
And even then, a man such as myself who normally enjoys goals and splendour, I was enjoying this game.
Mmm. Splendour made me think of the sugary thing.
The pretend sugar.
But it's American, isn't it?
I get it here.
This game was so fun.
Yeah.
It was really fun to watch. A very exciting 0-0. I don't know. It was really interesting tactically as well. When you break it down, we did a video on it on TIFO IRL, which you can see on the internet.
Yeah.
It's listed on the internet. Loads of things that were really interesting. I think some of the things you pointed out were that you saw Bernardo Silva dropping deep with Gundogan and swapping around. Like, did they do that before? They do it all the time. Like, Bernardo is amazing at dropping deep. Sometimes you think of him as an attacking player, like a right winger sometimes, coming onto his left, and he's brilliant there. But he tends to play very much in the middle of the pitch in the last couple of seasons, dropping deep to help him build up phases. He is one of the best players, that's too superlative, but one of the best players I've seen, like, being able to just control the ball in tight spaces and go around people. He's incredible at carrying it under tight situations.
Quite undervalued as a skill, isn't it?
Honestly, if he was at Barcelona, if they had managed to get him in the summer, he'd think he was one of the best players I'm going too nuts.
Sure.
I don't think you are. I think that's okay.
I think he's brilliant.
I think he's brilliant too.
Doing that is really useful for the way City want to play. But if you look at the average positions and we actually, or just watch the game, you see that Bernardo Silva was often, although he was playing deep to help the build-up and was sometimes on the right and sometimes on the left, he was mostly helping to double up with Phil Foden on that left side of City's attack. So it's almost as if, although City knew that Liverpool would probably play that 4-2-3-1 that they've changed to, so they could easily beat them with a three in midfield. Well, Firmino drops in to make it a three. They could flood that bit. Instead, they were flooding the wide areas to try and dominate them there, stopping them being able to play. And we know that lots of teams focus on Liverpool's right side recently because it's been weak. It just has, with Alexander-Arnold there really exposed, with Salah not helping him out on the right side. Harvey Elliott's been playing right side midfield, not helping out as much as you want. So lots of reasons for Alexander-Arnold struggling a little bit at that, but he's not in the team. And Milner, I thought, was excellent at right back.
He was very good, wasn't he? I suppose he's doing something very different to what Alexander-Arnold does. By the way, yeah. I mean, we are going to come on to talk about Liverpool, who won the game, but I think this is an interesting point to observe. I think it would be easy to watch that game and go, oh, James Milner's a better right back than Alexander-Arnold. He's just doing a completely different thing.
Yeah, he's right? Not. Like, and I think I said this in my Tifo IRL video, is that, remember, like, Alexander-Arnold is a really special player. I think Gary Neville did a really good bit on this at Monday Night Football the other week. If anyone's not seen it, it was really good. He's an incredibly talented player. He's a really attacking player. And when Liverpool are in the ascendancy, to quote Pro Evo commentary, they push right up the pitch. He can then create in those really difficult areas to create from, whether it's deep and wide or like in this middle section or half space, anything like that. Brilliant player. He can defend. We know that. He just sometimes get caught in the wrong position, as you would when it's not your natural skill set. But like, you take all the good because the bad's so rare. But teams are just finding a way to get past Liverpool because they're weak all over the place at the moment. Yeah. There's loads of structural issues there. Milner is, if you're trying to run towards a right back, would you rather try and run past James Milner, who's going to get stuck in?
Yeah.
Or Alexander-Arnold, who will try and win it cleanly with good technique.
The way I like to think about this, do you remember the game? I don't know if it's, presumably elsewhere it's called something different, but at school they called it British Bulldog. And for people who don't know what that is, you would have a pitch. Everyone would be on one side of it. There'd be a few people in the middle. And the task would be for the people on the side to run all the way across without being touched or caught.
How did you fare in British Bulldog?
I was pretty good.
I'm a nippy young
Divine. Well, exactly. Indeed. Who on earth wants to try and stop me? Yeah. Well, I think James.
It's like when you drive a lorry down the street in Grand Theft Auto and it just flies off.
That's what it's like when I walk down the pavement. Yeah. People just get out of my way.
Like an extreme version of the Verve video.
Yeah. Anyway, Mo Salah, I think he was better in this game than I've seen him for such a long time. He was exhilarating.
Well,
to watch.
I'll tell you why that is. So
yeah, please do.
For this season, the change in structure for Liverpool means that Salah is very much in the wide right. And what they do, I've been reading Pep Linders' book, he's the assistant manager at Liverpool, and they keep talking about these flexible triangles on the right and the left. They always play wide triangles. And the triangles between Alexander-Arnold, the right side of midfielder, normally Henderson, Harvey Elliott at the moment, and Mo Salah. And they would swap around. That's when you get those rotations, positional rotations, where Alexander-Arnold might end up central and Salah stays wide, and they swap around basically. It's all, as long as they have those positions in the final third filled, it's fine. But as teams focus on that left side, they've kept Alexander-Arnold deeper this season, so he's not quite as connected to Salah as he once was. They're not covering the spaces that he's left before as well, and Salah's been staying really wide right. And his touches, if you go through touch maps of the last few games this season, he's very much tied to that right-hand side as a winger. So you're trying to support other players like Darwin Nunez or Firmino in the middle of the pitch, or Jota, something like that. And in this game, they play him through the middle. So it's like a 4-4-2 or a 4-2-3-1. It's very much the same, interchangeable. But because he's playing in the through the middle, he takes up a sort of right half-space position. Like if you watch Ronaldo play for Man United, he's a central striker, but really he's a left half-space kind of striker because he plays just to the left of that and likes to be out of the game. Salah was doing similar things to what Pete Ronaldo might have done, but he's playing on the right half space. He's dropping deep stick players out of the game, then sprinting him behind because he's really quick. He had space to run into because of the way that City lined up at set pieces, especially. They had control of the game mostly, but when they went forward with set pieces, they were open, and that's when Liverpool scored. It's the long ball up top to Salah, and the one time they're really exposed.
Who, by the way, can I say, watching him against Ruben Diaz, who's a big lump of a guy, yeah. You know, he pushed him around. Ruben Diaz had the kind of game I was saying to Seb before, where if like one of us had had that game in a five-a-side or, you know, Sunday league or whatever, and we were pushed around by a smaller person, that's the kind of game where you get made fun of by your teammates afterwards for being, do you know what I mean? It felt like that, didn't it?
Salah's really technically good, but also he's center of balance. Sorry, is that the word? Center of balance?
Center of gravity.
Center of gravity, yeah. Like, he's really well balanced. That's why he's able to do that dribbling like Messi does, where he goes through people and it seems like he's just running. Like, I would fall over.
You can't push him over.
Because he's really strong. Yeah, that's the thing. It's he's got really good core strength. That's one of the big things. That's the thing. Gordon Strachan was obsessed with, actually. I remember him talking about core strength.
Is that when he went on that rant about genetics and why that was?
I think it was part of it, but he was talking about how that's the thing you need is core strength. You don't have to be like so strong you can barge people out the way like you're a lorry in Grand Theft Auto. Mm. But if you're such that you're so strong that people then bounce off, you don't expect it because you don't look it.
Yeah,
that's really useful.
Well, Steve Hankey makes the point in the podcast plan here that actually the post match interview was with Salah and Virgil van Dijk. I was going to make a comment about that as an aside, which was to say that they really played down like how big a win it was. Which I understand why. But Steve Hankey makes the point, like, you know, if Virgil van Dijk is roughly the same height as Ruben Dias, you can see the size difference when Salah stands next to van Dijk, and that's what he's dealing with on a 90-minute basis. Right. Did you watch this game, John?
I did.
Can I ask you a question then? Kevin De Bruyne was positioned on the left a lot in this game, and I don't think I've really seen that before.
He was normally, right. All his touches were right.
Yeah, but towards the end of the game, he was dominant on the left wing, which is why I ask, because I've never seen that before. Do you know why?
I'm not sure. I think part of the confusion about the way that Man City were setting up was because we often expect to see Cancelo on the left-hand side. Mm. Obviously, Cancelo's over on the right for this game. And that meant that I think a lot of Man City's attacking patterns look quite different. We often see them doing a lot of like overloading on the left-hand side to then get the ball to someone like Mahrez on the right, isolated. And I wonder whether or not that was just a last throw of the dice by Pep to try and get this one going.
But try and break through.
It was a really interesting game. Here's John McKenzie to talk about boring off-ball stuff.
Sure.
But
I like how you've
people do say that a lot about you, yeah.
Is that your collective voice for people that are nasty to you?
That's hoi polloi.
Yeah, that's that nice. Yeah. That's really well done. You workshop that for quite a while, that voice.
Yeah, that's right. I lie awake at night being like, oh, that John McKenzie.
Yeah. Now we've had our fun, say the boring thing.
I was quite surprised because Man City basically went man for man, player for player, I should say, out of possession when Liverpool were building up from the back. And I think it worked pretty well for the first half. I think Liverpool barely created anything in the first half, but in the second half, it felt as though Liverpool went a lot more direct. And if you actually look at an XG plot for the game in the second half, you see those big jumps where Salah had a few really good chances to score where he got one-on-one against Alisson, etc. And that obviously towards the end, the game sort of opened out a little bit more. But I did feel as though the going player for player, like it exposes you because you do end up with those 1v1 duels, and if they don't go well, you can be pulled apart. And obviously that's what happened for the goal, was that Cancelo was left 1v1 with Salah. Now I think you would obviously leave your fullback in those sorts of situations because it's straight from a set piece.
Yeah.
But usually we talk a lot about rest defense, and usually you would have a more robust rest defense structure, I think, in those situations. But it literally meant that Alisson could just find Salah. Salah could roll Cancelo, and then he was through on goal. Mm. So it seemed like a really high risk strategy to me. But this game actually felt, and I'm going to get panned for this, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Okay.
Yes.
It felt like the first time I'd seen Liverpool Manchester City, where one of the teams had played underdog football.
Right.
I think in previous matches it's been quite tetchy and close because they've both played very similar styles and they've kept it pretty defensive. Whereas in this one, it did feel like Liverpool sat a little bit deeper, just absorbed the pressure and knew that they could hit on the break. And in the end, it worked out for the better.
Maybe a stylistic change at the top. Exciting. I mean, listen, if that happens again, I would enjoy it because it certainly made the game. I can't think of another Liverpool-Man City game that was as exciting as that. I know there was the 2-2, all the four goals in the second half last season, but...
Well, they were better matched in the past because they were both competing so high, and it has felt like they dropped off a little bit this year, Liverpool, so you can't play the same way. Also, they are shipping the same sort of goals. I mean, I've watched a lot of Liverpool recently, and they're shipping the same goals from the same place, the same problems they've had, so they're trying to lock that down in this game, but still offer an attacking threat. There were phases of play, like 10-minute phases, where City had about 91% possession.
Yeah.
When that just happens with City, they're going to control it. It's weird. When you look at any lineup, I've gone through like who scored and why scored, everything. Everyone lists City as like a 3-4-3 or something like that, but it's not. It's just there's no formation. It's just lots of players in different places. And they only lost because of that really magical like turn by Salah to win it. I thought Joe Gomez was brilliant in this game. It wasn't he did anything different or his position differently. He just played much better. Like, he got torn apart by Napoli.
He was player of the match, wasn't it? I think
he got one. Yeah, he like against Napoli, he was bodied by Kvaratskhelia. I've said his name wrong. Kvaratskhelia. I love that guy.
Say it for us, John.
Kvaratskhelia.
Okay.
Kvaratskhelia. And this game,
you should remember that because it sounds a bit like skeleton. And you like skeletons.
Does he really like skeletons?
I like skeletons
does
a lot.
Sound
yeah.
like skeleton.
We'll say it again.
Kvaratskhelia.
Ferex skeleton.
That does actually help.
Yeah. A little neonic device for you there.
I just need skeletons everywhere.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this then.
Yes.
You know, this game was a 1-0. Yes. Another 1-0. Was it 1-0? Arsenal beat Leeds 1-0,
yes,
didn't
indeed.
They? Which leaves them now 4 points clear at the top of the table. Very exciting. I did see an Adam Crafton tweet over the weekend that said, you know, with apologies to the rest of the league table, but watching the Liverpool-Manchester City game, it's clear to me that these are the two best teams in the country. Do you think that's a little unfair? I don't want anyone throwing shade at Adam Crafton. I think it's fair. But do you think that's a little unfair on Arsenal this season, who have extended their lead by 4 points and are looking all the well for it?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say anything because, well, I'm going to say something, but judging by my Twitter @, I'm really well beloved by many Arsenal fans.
Sure.
And so I think Crafton did the same thing. He did a tweet where he's looking at the if you do the table by goal difference, was it Crafton? Someone else?
Michael Cox.
Was it Cox? See, I think that's Coxy. Yeah, I think that's quite a good way of looking at it. I think
Arsenal, and I can tell you that Arsenal's goal difference is plus 14. Manchester City's is plus 23, Tottenham's is plus 12, and then everyone else is.
Well, if you look at
Man United,
Liverpool
is minus 2.
Liverpool is quite high, but then Liverpool did beat Bournemouth 9-0, which I think probably skews that.
And their goal difference is 9. So outside of that game, they've run even.
Can I offer a counterpoint to the Liverpool thing? Like, it was the best I've seen Liverpool play in ages. But you get this within the confines of a rivalry and
What I've done is I've put you off there. But what I was indicating by touching my ear was, would you speak more loudly, please, sir?
Oh, okay.
I'd love to hear more of your...
Let's do a different gesture for that.
What, like chest out?
No. More of a kind of that or
that.
Or maybe that.
Well, I thought if I did this, you might stand
no,
up.
No, that's it. Sit more
What
sit,
I want you to
more
do is speak at
chair.
The level that you're speaking when I'm speaking over you.
Okay, because
try that, when I'm
that meant
anything.
It.
And
know,
go.
If this
okay.
makes it into the edit, it's a very good insight into how Joe and Seb talk often on this podcast.
So usually within the confines of a rivalry like this, when a game has decided titles, Champions Leagues, and other competitions on a regular basis, it has its own microclimate. So, and generally you can come into that even when you're off form, like a derby, and you can play sort of independently of the rest of your season performances. So John talked about underdog football earlier, and I think that's kind of a fair point because it's all of the conversation this year has been about Man City are unstoppable. What do you do with Haaland? Can't possibly be stopped. Liverpool are awful. End of cycle with Klopp. What are we going to do next? Bin off FSG. And so that creates the conditions for this kind of performance. Now, in a week's time, we may be talking about Liverpool's sort of resurgence and, maybe. But maybe signing off on that now ignores what we've learned about this kind of game in the past.
That's right, because in the current context, the title challenge game is Arsenal Man City, which is coming up fairly soon, I think. Oh, no, it was rescheduled, wasn't it?
It was supposed to be on Wednesday, it's been postponed.
Oh, that would have been a big week.
Really would.
It'll be so good watching those two teams play, because Arteta's the structural things are very similar to Guardiola, and it makes sense having managed under him and also being a La Masia graduate, all that sort of stuff. He'll come through the same school of thinking. And I think it's also interesting comparing Arsenal to Liverpool because they're at a similar stage in development that they had to develop under Klopp and they got better every year as Arsenal are doing under Arteta. And when Liverpool won the league, so this is my comparison I can do, is that when Liverpool won the league in 2019-20, they had to be, as Klopp has said many times, perfect to beat Man City because they are the best team. But Liverpool were the best team because they won the league and they overperformed in every major metric, like your XGA, so your expected goals against. They were 40 and they conceded 33 goals, so overperforming defensively. And then they also overperformed in expected goals as well. So their expected was 71 and they scored 85. So it's an overperformance top end of the pitch, overperformance at the back end. That's how they won the league, because you have to be better than perfect to beat Man City.
Sure,
that's how you do it. Now, Arsenal, is this sustainable? They are currently Their XGA, sorry, their XG, expected goals for, is 18.5. They've scored 24. They're overperforming at the top. That's good. And when you have momentum and confidence, you can ride that out.
Yeah.
Expected goals against, 9.9. They've conceded 10. That's roughly about exactly where they should be. So that's good. Now, the thing is, when you, like, I've watched the highlights of the Leeds game, not seen the whole thing, so I can't tell you exactly what happened with this, but to me, the stuff that Leeds were creating and some of the errors that Gabriel, who's made a couple of errors in the last couple of games I watched him play, it's the kind of thing where they need a bit of luck to get through this, because otherwise it could fall apart and then you lose your confidence and your momentum and then it can derail a little bit.
Well, indeed, any title challenger needs a luck to win.
Of course, right? But the thing is, if they're getting through this, that's really good.
That's exactly that. Like, yeah. if you're an Arsenal fan, you've watched this season, you've enjoyed the kind of the fluency of the attacking play and the goals scored and the kind of the flair elements and also some of the kind of the flair defending, some of the way in which Saliba defends, or so far has done this season, isn't exactly back to the walls on it kind of stuff.
Sure.
This was Arsenal not playing well, Arsenal suffering under the weight of a pretty packed schedule. I mean, they had a difficult away game on Thursday night, which they won, but didn't play well in, and they got through this. So you see a kind of an examination of a different set of attributes, which felt instructive. I felt, like if I'm an Arsenal fan, I think you want to see 3-0 easy wins on the road because it's easier for your heart rate. But at the same time, you feel a little bit more confident about, your cornerstone players and your resilience.
This is the kind of win that we see.
Oh no,
champions win.
Well, I don't know.
It is. I'm not saying they're going to win. I'm just saying.
Can I rephrase it?
All I'm saying is that this kind of difficult away from home, doesn't concede a goal and scrapes 3 points victory, is the kind that we see from every Premier League champion.
Can I rephrase just
10 years,
to something that I'd be more happy with? This is like, inevitably, over the course of a 38 game season, you are not going to play well in games. And so as a result, you are going to have matches like this where you don't play well and you still get performances. It's not necessarily indicative of something, but it's a tool that you need to have on the Premier League road.
Yes.
To winning.
I can see John McKenzie sort of tweaking to speak, and we are going to move on to the next topic. Last thing, please. Go. You've spoken enough, but speak more. You haven't spoken at all. Speak more. Come on.
I think in terms of, we need to contextualise, and the thing is that Leeds are an outlier.
He's always trying to make us contextualise.
No, I know, but like, Leeds are an outlier side, right? So they are playing in a style of, they're playing a style of football which is going to cause Arsenal a lot of problems.
Mm.
And Arsenal will move on next week and not play a team that's going to be aggressive, pressing, and trying to stop teams who are going to try and build up through them. So I think this is an outlier result or performance from Arsenal. And I also think that it's probably an outlier performance from Liverpool as well. So to say that Liverpool and City are the best team in the league off the basis of one performance in the same week that Arsenal are playing a team who are also having a bit of an outlier performance as well.
Are you calling out Adam Grafton directly? On this podcast.
Does sound like it, doesn't it?
Sounds it like
really
it.
Does sound like
I,
it.
Is Adam a friend of the podcast? Obviously fantastic.
I mean, less
writer.
So now. I mean,
it's a weird sort of feud to start, but is that what you're doing?
I respectfully disagree with Adam Crafton's statement because I think it's clear that like the best team, if you look at the numbers, the best team in the league, Man City, Arsenal, the second best team quite comfortably.
Right.
Arsenal could win the league because you like the numbers aren't always indicative of what happens.
Well, indeed, because they are top of the league
at the
moment.
That's kind of how it is.
And the thing is, when something magic happens in a season, like if Arsenal were to win the league, it would be amazing that they'd done it. It would be really cool. And to make that happen, they need things to swing their way, like little luck. And that's why football is amazing, because sometimes these things do happen. And if they keep up the way they're playing, they will win lots of games. They will lose a couple, but they need the luck to go their way. And that game against Leeds, I think, looks like
an unfortunate consequence of rescheduling is that the Arsenal game that was due to take place on the Wednesday just gone is now on the 26th of April, which means that both of their ties will be in the second half of the season. So for teams who are currently 1 and 2, that is kind of fun, isn't
it? Kind of like the Classico quintet of games from all those years ago. That's brutal.
The World Cup's going to make things go really weird as well. I remember this is the first half of the season, and then what's going to happen is that there's going to be a break. They don't really get a proper pre-season altogether. Well, I mean, they probably will have. We'll see how it happens in the World Cup. But then the second half will be very different. It's sort of resetting and starting again. And it might just change. Like, if they've got all momentum, it could be that derails them. Or they come back and they're resurgent and they're amazing again. It could be,
Well, listen, let's move on now. I want to talk about AFC Bournemouth, because AFC Bournemouth haven't lost a game in the Premier League since the 9-0 defeat that we referenced just before against Liverpool. They're currently 10th in the top half. And we thought it was high time to talk about those cherries. And to do that with us now is The Athletic's Bournemouth reporter, Ahmed Schubel. Hi, Ahmed.
Hey, Joe. Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Good, good. Just recovering from a cold, but other than that, all good.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, let's snot our way through. I want to start with a Who Scored tweet that I see that you have retweeted, Ahmed, which says, since Gary O'Neill took over as Bournemouth boss on a caretaker basis, only Manchester City, Tottenham and Arsenal have claimed more points than the Cherries. So the first question, I suppose, is why hasn't he been given the job permanently yet?
That's a good question. I'd probably say it would have a lot to do with the fact that Bournemouth will probably have a new owner quite soon, a new ambitious owner. And my understanding is that Bournemouth would probably prefer to make an external appointment. They're used to making sort of interim or making interim managers permanent. They did it with Jonathan Woodgate a couple of seasons back. But that was only because they had Scott Parker, who was at Fulham at the time, in the waiting in the wings. And they knew that it would go to pot with Fulham at the end of the season. And then they could just sort of grab him at the end of the season. That's why Woodgate went towards the end. So I think this season they haven't really got a manager waiting in the wings. They've got a short list, which they're constantly tweaking, and the prospective owner, Bill Foley, is constantly being kept abreast of. But yeah, I think because O'Neill is doing a very good job, I think that must be stated, of course, but like he's still very new at this managerial thing. This is his first real sort of head coach role. He started out as a member of Jonathan Woodgate's coaching staff, then stayed on with Scott Parker. So this is the first time he's actually the main man in the hot seat in the dugout. So yeah, I think it might come a bit too soon for him, this Bournemouth role.
Okay, thank you. We'll come to the takeover in a second. But Seb, you had a conversation with Ahmed over the weekend, didn't you? Would you like to talk about that and ask a question?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I've watched my fair bit of Bournemouth highlights, Ahmed, but what's actually changed within the defending, like within the detail of it, beyond it just being better?
I think Bournemouth are a lot more sort of proactive in their defensive actions. They were quite reactive under Parker. They definitely sat back a lot. Bournemouth pressed, obviously, as one of the best teams in the Championship last season. They had a lot of the ball. And so when they did lose it, they counter-pressed. They were a heavy sort of pressing from the front team. And we're starting to see glimpses of that coming back. Actually, in the Fulham game at the weekend, Bournemouth were pressing probably at their most intensely as they've seen them all season. We saw sort of Lewis Cook, who was one of the holding midfielders, further forward than Ryan Christie, who was playing at left wing, or right wing rather, trying to steal the ball off Tom Kearney and Jao Paulinha when they were playing out the back. So yeah, I guess they're definitely a lot more intense in their defensive actions, just when they're sort of pressing from the front, when they're trying to squeeze opponents sort of against the touchline, trying to win the ball in that way. But it's also quite difficult to compare Bournemouth's performances, particularly in a defensive perspective, when you're looking at Parker and O'Neill, because Parker had four games this season. Three of them were against Man City, Liverpool and Arsenal. And so, yeah, those are quite restrictive games to sort of play against.
So a lot of the noises that came out of Bournemouth earlier this season, I mean, until Scott Parker departed the club, he talked very openly about not being able to compete and not being able to spend in the way that he might have wished to on returning to the Premier League. One of the differences seems to be that you no longer have a manager, at least from a media perspective, you no longer have a manager who's kind of inadvertently denigrating your abilities in public in front of the press. Is that something to read into? Is that something that is a sort of evidence of growing self-belief or, you know, more of a kind of a communal collegiate attitude within the squad?
Yeah, I think that's definitely been a factor, probably something that's a bit difficult to ignore. The players that I speak to on the record and off the record assert that while Parker said what he said in front of the media and maybe didn't paint the players in the best light or didn't really represent them in the way they might have liked to, he was, when he was with them, without the cameras involved, he was top with them, and he maintained the level of professionalism that you would expect with them. So, and they were quite surprised to hear that he was sacked. So yeah, you can read into that what you will, but O'Neill has kind of cleared up a lot of that mess. And immediately when he was interim, his first press conference asserted that he kind of disagreed with what Parker was saying, in the sense that he doesn't think this player is good enough. He definitely feels like these players are ready. And you get the sense that he's almost proud to be, even as an interim. He knows that he's probably not going to get the job full time. But, you know, there is that sort of collective spirit that he's fostered that you touched on there, that he's definitely sort of had to sort of spruce back up again, because going 9-0 down to Liverpool in the way that they did, hearing what your manager says, like, player confidence has got to be rock bottom. That's got to be some of the most damaging things you could say as a manager, really.
Yeah.
And you can see that in the way that Bournemouth handled the decision to sack him so quickly afterwards. So yeah, I think O'Neill's done a really good job there as well.
Was that harsh with Parker? Because he must not have been able to make his team play the way he wanted to at the start of the season. They beat Villa at the start of the season, right? That was the first game, I think. Mm. And then what's it, Arsenal, City and Liverpool. Mm. I mean, that's kind of hard.
Yeah. Wasn't the argument around that, though, that it was less about the results and it was more about what he was saying?
Atmosphere.
Was saying, and, saying, like, but, we can't win.
But I mean, you can't done. Against City and you, like, Liverpool doing you 9-0. You would think, I mean, maybe... Did he change his approach an awful lot from what was working so well in the Championship for those games specifically? Was the Villa game, did he play very much like the first... Oh, sorry, like last season in the Championship and then had to change it for those three games to try and... contain, but they just couldn't do it because he didn't have the players to do that, and he knew it trying to press up high would be like really dangerous.
Yeah, so last season they played a very attacking 4-3-3. The two attacking number eights, much like Manchester City, would make a front five, so it would be like a 2-3-5 at times. They'd have a lot of the ball, counter-pressing in that way. A lot of similarities with Pep City. But this season, you know, completely different. A 5-3-2. Parker always wanted to go five at the back in a similar way to what he did with Fulham when they were promoted as well. And with that, he wanted more defenders. I think they started the season with just three centre-backs, two of which, Chris Meppham and James Hill, weren't really even starters in the Championship. And to rely on them in the Premier League was always going to be a bit of a struggle. So, yeah, but at the same time, you know, that when Parker made those comments after the Liverpool game, that was not the first time he'd done that. He did that in pre-season. He did that a couple of times during pre-season, actually. And he was told, my understanding is that he was told from the higher-ups, like, look, we get that the situation isn't great. We get the results aren't going your way. And we get that it's difficult to go out in front of the cameras after results like that and have to justify and answer those hard questions. But it wasn't public knowledge at the time, but the club was going through a sale. And when your manager is saying that, you know, I don't know how long we're going to last in the Premier League for, and Bournemouth are looking to cash in on their Premier League status when selling the club, that's not exactly what you want to be hit. That's not what you want to be hearing. So it's something he was definitely warned about, but it's not really something that he felt like he could keep. It probably felt like conditions that he felt were sort of beyond him. But I guess Gary O'Neill's kind of, proved him wrong in that respect, hasn't he?
He's certainly a company man. John, what is it that you like about Bournemouth this season?
Can I talk about what I don't like about Bournemouth?
You can. You continue to
buck
my authority, yeah. Don't you? Continue to...
Oh, here comes John McKenzie to say something boring.
Oh. Here we go. Come on, John.
You've been practicing your voice of the crowd's voice.
Yeah. Man of the people.
Yeah. No, my point's simply going to be, it looks as though since the 9-0 loss, Bournemouth have been wildly overperforming their numbers. Looking at the expected goals for and against, it seems as though every result they've had since then has gone lucky for them. So they've got draws when they should have lost, and they've won when they should have drawn, and things like that.
He's trying to contextualize it again. So, Ahmed, does this ring true to you?
Fairly, yeah. I do get what you're saying. I've had a look at the XG numbers, particularly in that Nottingham Forest game. The XG Bournemouth had to score three goals was nowhere near. Like, you saw Philip Billing's cracker from like 30 yards, Dominic Solanke's overhead kick in a very congested box, and I think Jaden Anthony's winner was probably the only clear-cut chance they created in that game. So yeah, I guess you could definitely say that. And then I guess that probably goes back into the whole new manager bounce sort of thing, players playing confidently, taking chances that they probably wouldn't have done under Parker, with the environment being a little bit quite miserable when he was manager there. So yeah, I guess you could. That's probably one explanation as to why they're overperforming the numbers. But I wouldn't say they're lucky. In fact, if you ask most Bournemouth fans, they'd say that quite a few VAR decisions have gone against them. So yeah, take that, Joe.
Ahmed, over the weekend I was reading your piece on Bill Foley, the prospective new owner of Bournemouth, and one of the things you mentioned was because of the way Bill Foley runs his sports franchises in the US, there's a bit of concern about things like obviously the kind of the rolling out of a more dynamic commercial model, but also the pricing of for fans in stadium, so relating to things like season ticket and food and that kind of stuff. What's the kind of the expectation? I mean, I'm not familiar with the kind of, what's the ice hockey team called? The Las Vegas
Golden
Black
Knights.
Super Knights. Yes, that's one. but it's an interesting thing because it's that classic case of like a cultural clash between what works and what's tolerated in franchise culture versus what works in the Premier League. And one of the statistics you came up with was that for a supporter, his ice hockey arena was the fourth most expensive for fans in the United States. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that was by a study conducted by money.co.uk, I believe, yeah.
Yeah. What are the indications about what Bournemouth are likely to experience under his ownership?
Well, the key word, I guess, with Foley's involvement with Bournemouth is expansion, and Bournemouth's commercial value or commercial imprint in terms of especially being a Premier League club is not big at all. That's definitely something that Foley is looking to expand. And the main way they'll want to do that is through sponsorships. The Golden Knights, Foley's hockey team, are very sponsorship heavy. If you look at their alcohol, they've got like a beer sponsor, a gin sponsor, a vodka sponsor, sort of a wine sponsor, Foley's own wine company, Foley Family.
Yeah, he owns a wine company, doesn't he? Yeah.
And there's probably a thinking that he'll probably get that involved with Bournemouth as well. There is an appetite from the new ownership to increase Bournemouth's commercial footprint, because that is an avenue of revenue that they definitely need to boost, particularly because
maybe they could have a cherry sponsorship.
Do you know what I was thinking, Joe? You know that meme that you always see of the spider, and they give the spider different drugs and it makes different sizes, different kinds of webs?
No,
there's this thing.
And you get like, there's a thing, and it's a spider. So like, if it has weed, it does a certain kind of thing. If you give it speed or like cocaine or something,
these are different types of illegal drugs.
So it can make different kinds of webs. That's the joke. Yeah. So then, what they could do with Bournemouth is they can make them play different Premier League games, having consumed a bottle of gin.
Yeah, that's good.
And see what the patterns look like.
I didn't know about that meme, but a valuable contribution. Thank you, JJ. As a pickup point for the bit that we just cut out. Ahmed, I just want to ask you before you go about Fulham, because you just watched them, didn't you? They're good.
Yeah, they are pretty good, especially with that old Micho up front. He's actually quite menacing. Like, seeing him, because it got to a point where Bournemouth had like a back seven seeing out the game, and Fulham were just pumping crosses into the box, and seeing him like lurk from back post to back post across it was almost like seeing a shark's fin out of the water. Yeah. It was very menacing, and you could see
he's got the rounded shoulders thing, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's
frightening.
It was quite scary to watch. But to be fair, Chris Meppham, who a lot of Bournemouth fans wouldn't have thought had much of a chance of having a sustained role to play in this team as he has done, he basically, particularly in the first half, won every header he contested with Mitrovic. But then again, Mitrovic, question marks over whether he was fully match fit, whether he was fully applying himself, or maybe he was brought back a bit too early. But no, yeah, that's
sure.
Fulham are quite good. Yeah, that's true.
Well, kudos to Chris Meppham. Joao Palhinha, you think he's a top lad, JJ.
This boy's amazing.
Good player.
He's really good.
Good player.
I hadn't noticed him as much, and I was talking to, I think, a Tifo fan actually somewhere, I can't remember what his name was. He's a very nice guy, but he was saying how Sports Fulham and Palhinha is just the reason they're playing so well a lot of the time. This guy signed from Sporting, Portuguese defensive midfielder, is £20 million, I think. He used to play in a double midfield two, in like a 3-4-3 for Sporting, alongside Mateus Nunes, the guy that will sign for a bunch of money.
Sure, yeah.
Two really good players. But this guy, so we're in the past, we talked about how good like Wilfred Ndidi is, because he finishes top in tackles and blocks and all these sorts of things. Well, Palhinha this season has made more tackles than any other player and more pressures than any other player in the league this season, playing for this Fulham side, doing it really well. But he's also got great technique. He can switch to play with these beautiful long passes. And the way he reads the game, the reason his tackles are so high and his pressure is so high is because he sits slightly deeper when Fulham go forward, but then times his run to sneak in front of people. There's loads of examples of him doing it this season where he sneaks in and steals the ball, and that's what keeps Fulham up the top end of the pitch, so they can be slightly more attacking than they might otherwise be.
Yeah.
And they're playing quite well under Marco Silva. I think they're all right, Fulham, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, there we go. That's the end of the first part. Let's all say thanks and goodbye to Ahmed. Bye, Ahmed Schubel. Bye. Thank you for joining
us. Thanks, Ahmed.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Hello, James Richardson here, presenter of the Totally Football Show. It's a show about football, and sometimes it's about life, and usually it's about an hour long. This Thursday, it's particularly about the midweek Premier League games, Ten Hag against Conte, South Coast Derby dust-up between Bournemouth and Saints, and the story tradition of the All-West London Brentford-Chelsea clash. I'll be asking dumb questions. Duncan Alexander, Carl Anker and Ahmed Schubel will have clever answers, and you can find all of that by searching for The Totally Football Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Ah, what a lovely... Oh, what a lovely break that was. Delightful. Now to the continent, as we say. Real Madrid 3, 1 Barcelona. Goodness gracious me. Seb, what happened here? El Clasico number 1 of the season.
Well, Real Madrid won, but they also won through an entirely predictable sequence of events. Mm. So one of the things coming off their bad night against Inter Milan in the Champions League was an increased vulnerability in defensive transition. And if you look at the first goal, if you were a betting man, I think you would have seen that as the source of the first goal in this game. Just because it's not so much what happens after a ball is turned over, it's all of the protections which Barcelona don't seem able to build into their attacking play. So before the weekend, I went back through Y-Scout to look at all of the attacking opportunities they've given up. And it's absolutely amazing how many chances begin with them taking attacking set pieces or having the ball in the attacking third and then misplacing a pass and allowing the opposition to progress up the field. And one of the things that was interesting is that if you watch the goal, the first goal they concede, forget the point at which Toni Kroos plays the ball, because it's already too late. Look at the absence of pressure the Barcelona are applying on Real Madrid players when the ball is turned over. Also remember that the basis of so many of those good Barcelona teams in the past, like the great Guardiola team, the great Tito Villanova team, they were hardworking sides. They were amazingly gifted and they had wonderful players, Iniesta, Messi, Xavi, et cetera, et cetera. But they worked extremely hard without the ball and they were incredibly well-disciplined without it too.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't exist. And so in that first goal and to a certain extent in the second, what you see once Real Madrid work the ball into attacking situation is panic, like players running hell for leather back to try and cover position, reacting to things as they happen rather than relying on proper structures, making mistakes, but also allowing really bizarre things to happen. So
it's a lack of intensity, isn't it?
It sure is. And I don't want to describe that as a lack of effort, but it's a lack of properly focused intensity, isn't it?
It's like, hard you're to not, get it. Yeah, I totally agree.
It's really difficult.
It's the kind of thing that you see, like Newcastle playing really well because they're really intense. It's when Liverpool were at their best, they were really intense. Arsenal are really intense just now. You're trying to win the ball back.
Yeah.
City are really intense. And it's like when they win the ball back, you're not getting a back off of them. That's the thing. And they just expand immediately and can do it. That's what Barcelona
I felt like.
I want to come back to talk about the football element of it, but I want to also address the kind of financial element of it, John, because now Barcelona are out of the Champions League. It is apparently imperative that they win La Liga as a result of the various levers.
They could still stay in. They could.
Yeah.
If Inter don't beat Victoria Pilsen.
Oh, is it not a done deal?
They have to beat Bayern Munich as well. Yeah,
it's not a done deal.
It's very, very unlikely that they're going to qualify, but they need the chips to fall in their favour, basically.
They need some chips.
They also need to beat Bayern Munich.
Some chips,
which is,
you know, some midday chips. But anyway, speaking of chips and levers. Oh, chips.
See, you just, I could see your eyes, and this is a way for you to lose focus.
Thinking about mayonnaise.
Yeah, but we shouldn't have this on, you know.
Chip shop chips, fish and chip shop chips.
Yeah, probably the best. Yeah.
Not
loaded
like
with vinegar and
chips.
Ones. Yeah.
I once went to Bakewell, the town of Bakewell, where they do make the
Bakewell
tart comes from, which is actually very different to what we all think it is. Yeah, the original. Anyway, I won't go into that. But there's a pub opposite the co-op in Bakewell that does delicious fish and chips. The fish comes stacked on top of the chips. The chips are just like the size of my arm. They're so fat. They're all square, perfectly. I feel like they must have found the largest baking potatoes possible. And, you know, when you see a tabletop made of wood, you think, how big was the tree? I don't know how wood is made. it's like that when you see the chip and you think, wait, is this the whole
potato? Yeah.
Oh, my good Lord. It was
what
fantastic.
What is it about Barcelona's financial situation which troubles you?
Well, indeed, because as with the chips, there's a large stake at hand. That doesn't work. Anyway, the point I'm making is it's very important that Barcelona do well on the football pitch this season as a result of things off the football pitch. John McKenzie, would you care to chips?
I'm thinking about steak now.
Yeah.
That's definitely
awful. It's a real problem, isn't it? We've got a negative circle here.
Feels like forever since we've talked about the finances of Barcelona when we went through a phase of talking about them every week because it was the most interesting thing happening in football.
But let's do it again.
Let's do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we talked at the time about leveraging your future against results, basically. And the problem is that there's a very possible world out there where where Barcelona perform exactly the same this season as they did last season, having spent all of this money that they didn't really have. And it means that they'll be in the same situation next summer with less things to leverage.
Yeah, so what will happen? I mean, would it be bad?
Yeah, I mean, as time goes by, you obviously have to start, that these debts will start being called in. I think one of the biggest issues is that they owe their footballers a lot of money.
Right.
And as each season goes on, the added revenue that you should be getting through being the best team in the world, per their arguments, is not going to come in. And so you're spending like 40, 50 million pounds on a player just to keep them at the club.
Troubling.
And you're not seeing any sort of upside from it. So,
it's
not great. And you were in a league with Real Madrid, and this game, I think, was very much indicative of the problems of spending big to try and beat Real, because Barcelona...
Hasn't worked for City or PSG.
No, exactly. And Barcelona are playing that style of positional football that... over the course of a season will give you the best underlying numbers, but it doesn't always win you titles or Champions Leagues. That's the problem with Real Madrid. Have come, they've scored three goals from very low chances. Barcelona have played fine, but they've still ended up losing.
The second goal is a work of art. Like, it's one of my favourite goals all season, I think, just in terms of the decisions made by Vinicius, the role by Tchouameni. And
this is the Valverde,
like the from Valverde. It's like it's
Link playing the final third is lovely.
If you didn't watch the game and you just wanted to know the story of it from a single 30-second period, just watch that, because you see this perfectly choreographed attacking move with players who understand where their teammates are going to be, when to release the ball, and where the spaces and the vulnerabilities are in their opponent, versus a team who are expending a lot of energy and effort trying to cover space, but they don't really understand where the threat is coming from next. So it's like, it's reactive, reactionary football. And it's just a beautifully worked goal. It's very, very pure football from an attacking sense. Can I build on something? The finance thing. I was reading Dermot Corrigan's article in the Athletics. I can't speak at all. It's like my tongue is too big. In the Athletic this morning. And one of the lines that stuck with me was that Barcelona still owe money for the transfers of Philippe Coutinho, Miralem Pjanic, and the goalkeeper, Neto. Maybe Torres too, but it wasn't included in Dermot's example. They still owe 100 million euros, and that is due to be paid within the next 7 months. That is mind-bending
and
very frightening.
The big problem with them is that because they're trying to like compete right now so they can build revenue, so they can get
back to the same virtuous cycle,
place.
Right?
They need to be big now, because then in a few years it means they're going to have the ability to be able to compete. But what they've done is sign players that have made them, like, if it was a FIFA rating, like one better. Like Marcus Alonso's not going to make you better. You know, he's not playing there. Koundé's a good signing, fair enough. Kessié's a good squad signing, stuff like that. But if you want to build and like really go for something in the future, you've got Piqué and Busquets who are going to come to the end of their careers. So you use them to, like you would James Milner or
Gareth Barry. Maybe.
So like you're bringing through the next group of players. And the next group of players, they had Nico can play as that six. He's gone on loan somewhere, I think.
He's at Valencia. Yeah.
Valencia. You've got Gavi and Pedri. That's your two. That's your midfield you build around. And you accept that you're going to lose a little bit in the league, maybe. I think they're still, were they top before this? I'm not sure.
On goal difference. Yeah.
They had a really good... they were defending really well if you look at the actual games, but Ter Stegen is keeping them in games. What I'm trying to say is that they're overperforming defensively. Ter Stegen's keeping them in games. So if they're really trying to build something like the way we've seen teams at Liverpool and Man City transform and become something else, you don't have the same money. They want to be focusing on those players. Like you've got Rafinha
take their time about it as well, right? Isn't that what Xavi as a coach, that it all makes sense?
I think Guardiola came in back in the day and made them amazing, and then just had that core and made them really good. It was Ricard that was taking a lot of the players in to make them good in the first place. But you know, Messi wasn't starting under Ricard every single week, as far as I remember. It was a bit of a change in people, because then Guardiola came in and away went Ronaldinho, and they had the new generation came through, and that's when it really became special, because over time, and he started badly, but they got really good really quickly. So now the worry is that they don't think Xavi's maybe quite there. He's not got a very good record so far with them, but they are building, trying to make the squad stronger now so they can compete right now, but actually it's the future, they're going to be better. And then what you've got now is La Liga teams might go on strike, because what's clearly what seems to be, I can see, at the forefront of certain Spanish clubs' minds is having the Super League happen, because that's the way you can compete financially with the Premier League, because it's just dominating everything. So you cannot compete If you're trying to compete by signing Lewandowski up to at least 37
yeah.
on a massive contract, it's dangerous.
But this is the problem, though. Like, you have the situation, firstly, where Barcelona acknowledged they still need to get a lot of players off their wage bill. Okay, so there was a quote from someone within the organization, financial director of some kind, last week, who said that, okay, we expect this situation to be normalized by about 24, 25 that season. You're thinking, okay, that's cool, because Piqué is this age and Busquets and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Jordi Alba. But then you're also, what that calculation doesn't factor in is that Pedri, Gavi, Ansu Fati, these players will be coming up for renewal.
Yeah.
And they're coming up for renewal in a football world in which Barcelona no longer have financial primacy.
No.
And also, like, just like JJ's right, like, If your energy is expended on advocating for a Super League because you no longer feel you're able to compete, I don't understand the tactic of then trying to compete in the transfer market with a very similar approach, which can be bettered by Paris Saint-Germain, Manchester yeah. City, arguably by Munich because they're a better run club, Chelsea, maybe even Arsenal at the moment. They seem to be sort of more financially stable. So Manchester United, like there's just a lot of contradictions in it. And
I just want to clue in listeners to something you referred to just there, and that is that, as written by Dermot Corrigan, La Liga clubs are exploring the possibility of strike action within 14 sides, as well as league president Javier Tebas, due to meet Spain's the sports minister on Monday to discuss the ongoing threat of the European Super League. So this is the context behind which you speak, Seb.
Yeah, by acknowledging the need for a Super League, you are saying we no longer really have confidence in our ability to compete.
Mm-hmm.
So then you spend the summer trying to compete and digging a hole for yourself in 2 or 3 years when you're not quite out of your current hole. Like, we don't need to revisit kind of the politics and the kind of the issues with Barcelona's financial expenditure, but it just doesn't make sense. And it's also, you are settling for something which can never be quite as good as all those teams above you. You can have Robert Lewandowski, but you can only have him at the end of his career. You can maybe have a Pedri and a Gavi, but you have him at the beginning of their career before you potentially expose yourself again to kind of the financial might of those clubs that you're raging against with your Super League ideas.
Mm.
So it is this vicious circle, a virtuous circle of, you know, advertising revenue and performance and winning and trophies that Joan Laporta imagines. It's a growing problem.
Yeah.
And the need for a different approach, the need for a reliance on something other than the transfer market has never been more obvious, in my opinion.
Well, in that regard, continuing with Dermot's piece, he says, you know, back when the Super League was originally announced, both the governing PSOE party and the main opposition party in Spain were strongly against the idea. But in recent weeks, they've both removed their complaints about the Super League amid ongoing political lobbying regarding the project, which is also currently the subject of competition law case brought by the three rebel clubs that are presumably trying to say that, well, to stop this from happening is a breach of... it's a monopoly. It's a breach of competitive.
You know when you know that noise that gets made when someone
like
drags a nail down a blackboard, and it's actually abhorrent. You can't listen to it.
Yes.
Like when someone says Super League, it has the same effect on me now. Like I can no longer listen. I can no longer engage with it. Like the kind of the
Super
wrangling
League.
You away for. Yeah, it's like it's just oh, it, or it's like you know, a really really loud alarm that just. It doesn't distract.
We have those here.
Yes, we do. We also have really, really loud drilling, which is
yeah.
great.
Well,
but the Super League is worse.
If it's given you that feeling, then I wonder if it's
it
given the listener
me,
at home the very same feeling.
Yeah.
Let's instead travel to a different area of the continent, an area which was never included in the Super League. It's Germany. Yeah? It's Germany. Anyway, just a quick top tip for anyone visiting Bakewell before we move to Germany. It was the Wheatsheaf Pub and Pantry. Delicious Pub and Pantry. I played a great game at the Pub and Pantry too, but I'll tell you more about that another time. Because Union Berlin 2-0 Borussia Dortmund, John McKenzie.
Yeah, Union march on.
I mean, they've cemented their position at the top. At the top. Of the table.
They have. They are top of the table. They are still there. A win kept them at the top of the table.
Yes.
Yeah, no one goal differenced them.
No. Are they good then?
Union Berlin are playing a style of football which is working at the moment.
Yeah.
I think they are maybe slightly overperforming their numbers, but they are playing a style of football which is set to give them joy in the Bundesliga.
Feels like a very political answer. What's your issue?
I don't necessarily have an issue with them, but I just think that what they're doing is they are playing very sort of reactive, counter-attacking football.
Right.
They have a couple of really on-form strikers right now.
Is it a Leicester? Can I make a Leicester comparison or no? Is that not fair?
I mean, yeah, I think you can. They're playing a different style of football, but it's the same kind of thing where everything's going right for them. Like outside of their games are going well for them.
Yeah.
But also other teams around them are not doing too well. So we've seen Bayern Munich haven't been the level that you might have expected in terms of their results. Dortmund, obviously they've lost, and now Dortmund have dropped like down to eighth in the league. So yeah, and
that
then
was them dropping down to eighth. A thunderous thunder. Yeah. Anyway,
Leipzig as well are nowhere near the top of the table. And then Leverkusen, who many of us, me included, thought would do okay this season, have been pretty dire. And
do you think Bayern still have a chance of winning it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they just beat Freiburg, who were second, I believe, going into this weekend. They beat them 5-0.
I would rather not talk about this.
Union are interesting because I think, like, I agree, John, like, they're overperforming, and Bayern Munich still look quite competitive this year, as always.
Just four points behind,
and Bayern Munich.
We've got a kind of a, it's like that's the same, I've interrupted you for no reason.
That's
carry
okay.
on.
That's okay. I can ride with the punches. Going there is difficult. Like Union Berlin play in a really sort of classically English ground. It's very tight. It's very, probably very intimidating for opposition players to go there. There is, I got to go a couple of weeks ago, and it's an amazing atmosphere. Mm.
That's the one where you walk through the forest?
You walk through the forest, yes, yes, yes. And it's a brilliant place. I've just finished reading Kit Holden's book about Union Berlin, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
But it's...
What's it called?
Scheiße, we're going up.
Ah,
yeah,
nice.
And it's great, but it's also, it helps explain why all of a sudden there's kind of this moment in time situation there, which is alongside the kind of the practical reasons, like the counterattack, those two forwards who play so well together, Becker and Jordan, there's an energy about Union Berlin, which is very unique in German football. And everyone, every week you go into the match days, you think, right, this is when it ends, this is when they lose to Dortmund. And every week they do something to kind of, to confound that. And it's a great story. It's a great story. And I know what German football is, and I know about Bayern Munich's history in over the last 10 years, but it's one of the best stories in European football there is at the moment. And so it's to be enjoyed. And also do read Kit's book, because there are some amazing human stories and tales of Union's revival and their history and kind of their position in German society. It's a brilliant, brilliant thing to be happening.
They're defending, which makes a difference. Like a lot of Bundesliga teams aren't too fussed about defending.
And right.
I think there's a reason for that, because the gap between financial gap between the Bundesliga and the Zweite Bundesliga, the second division, is obviously not as big as, for example, in the Premier League. So in the Premier League, I think at the bottom half of the table, you get a lot of teams who will just sit deep and then look to counter because they would rather draw than lose, which doesn't happen so much in Germany. But Union, if you look at their underlying numbers, like in terms of expected goal difference, they are in the bottom half of the table. So I know it's miserable to talk about the numbers all the time, and I realize I've done that a lot in this episode, but
they are
very much overperforming. It's not just like their second or third in the table. According to the underlying numbers,
what are the underlying numbers?
So Bayern Munich expected goal difference of about 12. Mm-hmm. Clearly the best team in the league.
Sure.
Hoffenheim are second, joint second with Leipzig. So those two are on plus 6, and then at 6 below that is Union Berlin and Dortmund, Frankfurt, Köln, Gladbach, and Freiburg and Werder Bremen are all ahead of them in terms of the underlying numbers. So,
well, listen, John McKenzie, I'll enjoy the real football while you enjoy the expected football.
I'll enjoy being miserable. Mm. No, I simply say this because, these things do have a funny way of sort of turning around at some point.
So we expect.
It would be unlikely that they would continue to perform at this sort of level.
It's an enjoyable situation.
The outcomes in football are the fun ones, aren't they?
Yeah, no, of course. And it's great seeing what they're doing. And hopefully it will have a big impact on German football, where teams realise actually you can get a huge amount of upside by playing a sort of solid defensive base and attacking.
That's the main thing. I hope it has a big impact on German football. Anyway, let's have a break now. And then when we come back, we'll abandon Germany and return to somewhere else.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yes, we're going for quite a long time. So let's speed through what's coming up now. Manchester United 0, Newcastle United 0. There's not tons to say about this, JJ, but a brief aside, given that you did make a video about this one.
Yeah, I'll do it really quickly. So Anthony only has a left foot. I mean, he literally has two legs, so that's good, but he could only use his left. He can't pass the ball with his right. It's becoming a problem because all you got to do is block him from... He's coming backwards. The ball goes out to him on the right, and then he has to go backwards, or he hooks the ball in. It's great. He's scoring goals. He's decent enough. He's a good player, but he's very much... He has one thing.
Sure.
And I think it's easy to stop him. Man United, very medium in this game. Not really offering anything that's really that exciting. They're not pressing. So they're not scoring many goals, but they're not really... What their problem is kind of chance creation. They had a couple of chances that he created by putting the ball in the box, and Rashford had a header he almost scored later on, and Ronaldo had an offside thing. But I think what they've got is that they're not creating chances through pressing, which is one good way to do it. Like the Liverpool Klopp idea is that you don't need a number 10 because you create your chances by turning people over in dangerous situations and then exploit the space that's left in those and people being in transition. Or you can have really clever players that thread passes through. They don't really have those. Bruno Fernandes will just like hit the ball forward, whatever. A lot of their chance creation is coming from wide, and then they're not really just scoring goals that way. But really, Newcastle they're genuinely good. They're playing like a total, like, whereas Man United are a bunch of still individual players who are...
Can I put this into context? You would expect Manchester United to win this game based on the players that they have.
If
right?
you look at the teams, they have the best players.
Yeah.
Man United do have the best players by far.
So despite the fact that Newcastle may not have been on top the entire game, they can still be brilliant as a result of that.
Yeah, if Man U played like how Newcastle did in this game, they would have won about 4-5-0 because they were so good. Like Newcastle were just really impressive. Play as a unit, defend as a unit, really intense. They do not let you go. They put the ball into the channel, they chase it. They put the ball over the top, they chase it. So it's not like they're playing long ball and just aiming it back and forward. It's almost like gaining territories. They put the ball into one bit and then they push up and they surround them and you can't get out. And Man United are struggling to play out from the back. They're just not very good at it still. But I really like watching Newcastle at the moment. If they have an injury to Callum Wilson, that's going to be really bad because they're missing Isak now till probably
at least three games.
Maybe after the World Cup, I think. Alan Saint-Maximin keeps getting the same hamstring injury. That's a problem. So you can't play him a lot. Almiron stepped up. They had Jacob Murphy playing in this game as well. He's okay. These are all right players, but it's the system and the camaraderie of the team that's working really well at the moment. If they can keep that, it's the same thing we were talking about earlier with Arsenal. If they can keep that going, they can really do something special with it. They could, at the moment, numbers say they could push the top four. They could do it.
Okay. Let's move to France now, where PSG claimed 3 points in Le Classique. And Lyon are having a bad time as well, Seb.
Yeah, Lyon are having a bad time. There was an amazing foul in the PSG Marseille game.
I should say, yeah, the Le Classique is PSG's Marseille.
Yeah, it is.
Lyon on a separate note.
PSG, chance creation pretty good. Finally took one of the chances, but probably the moment of... that game, or the one that's made the biggest impression on social media, is terrible tackle on Neymar. It was just like a sort of, it felt like a metaphor for everybody's frustration with PSG's superiority. But they are, yes.
Well, superior PSG, they are.
Looking competitive.
29 points, 11 games played. Serie A update as well. John, Napoli came back from a goal down to beat Bologna 3-2. That's fairly important for them in the league table. Staying top.
Yep. Napoli looking like the team to beat in Serie A at the moment, and the Champions League for that matter.
A good team. Would you say we talked about this last night. I'm not going to enter a long debate because we don't have time to talk about it, but it's really going to undermine my point that I can't remember the name of the coach who I said was
Luciano Spalletti.
He's doing a fine job, is he, in 10 seconds or less?
Yes, really good job. He's got a really fun team, squad to work with as well.
They're great fun to watch.
Delightful.
Really,
okay, well, also great fun to watch. Second place, Atalanta, who beat Sassuolo 2-1.
I watched this game. It was a good game, actually.
Was it?
Yeah.
Tell me the most interesting thing about this game.
Some absolute bangers of goals, actually.
Bangers.
The Sassuolo goal by Kyriakopoulos. Kyriakopoulos?
Kyriakopoulos.
Kyriakopoulos.
Yeah, really, really nice goal. Left-footed volley at the back post.
Yeah,
just clacked it in the top. And then Adamola Lookman's goal was lovely as well. Really well worked by by Atalanta. So
I'm just thinking about sausages because you said bangers and chips
Swallow.
Sausages.
Sausages. Speaking of Robbie Coltrane,
Robbie Coltrane. Yeah. What a guy.
The guy from invents a dictionary in Blackadder and it's all the best bits.
I shall return intophrastically.
Yeah, Baldrick he puts aardvark in.
I noticed not.
He puts sausages in and he's forgotten sausages. Yeah.
Well, he was fun.
He was very talented.
Yeah.
Nice guy as well, by all accounts.
Yes.
Which is the most important thing, I think.
Okay. Well, there we go. This one's for you, Robbie Coltrane. thanking all the people here, JJ Bull the Bullet.
Hello.
It's goodbye now, JJ.
Sorry, yes, I meant to say goodbye.
There he goes. Sebastian Stafford-Bloor.
Bye-bye, Jay Devine.
Goodbye. Jonathan Dog McKenzie.
Bye.
Bye. And, of course, producer Jamie over there. I think you can see in the background of JJ's camera. Jamie, swap yourself to JJ's camera. Then JJ, just shift yourself out. There he is.
That's a lovely hand. Lovely hand.
And Steve Hankey in his lampshade. Thanks, Steve Hankles.
You're welcome.
We'll be back next... look at him interrupting me, answering the question. You're a voiceless character on this show, Steve. Oh, thanks to Ahmed Schubel as well. And I should say, just before we go, buy the TIFO book, subscribe to The Athletic. Also, listen to John's podcast, which is second in this feed. If you're subscribed
it's
to
really
this
good.
Feed, you'll get it.
It's really
if you're
good.
Watching this on YouTube, do subscribe to the audio feed to listen to John's. Not all of them are released as videos. Who's coming out this week?
We are talking about Bayern, actually, this week with Justin Kraft. So he's a German Bayern expert.
Lovely.
So, yeah, lots of interesting things to think about there.
Exactly. Well, interesting. Those aren't the words I was trying to say. I was trying to say thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yes.
Okay, we'll be back next week. Well, I won't be. Michael Bailey will be here next week. I'm going away. But I'll be back the week after. Until then, ta-ra, goodbye.
When you said you're going away, it sounds like you're not coming back.
I'm going away.
Don't just go ever.